Randolph, I wanted to go back to talking about television. Mm-hmm. Something that you said about looking into the camera mm-hmm. sort of stimulated my imagination, and it took me back to the place of when we're growing up and our parents teach us, don't stare, that's not mm-hmm. polite. And therefore, I feel for myself there is a barrier and that I've had to work very strongly with when people look me directly in the eyes. And it's a conscious sort of thing for mm-hmm. me to... I use the word withstand it. And I'm thinking, when you were talking about doing a half hour on television mm-hmm. and you were talking about looking directly in the camera, and the possibility of how good that would be for people who maybe suffer from the same malady as myself, that they could really stand to look at someone in the eyes because it would be on television.
Exactly. Beautiful.
And still be able to share, I think, a very deep experience.
Yeah, that's beautiful because it's a low-risk situation because they can always turn it off if they don't like it or they can push it away. But otherwise, they just sit with it. It's beautiful because when I look into somebody's eyes, it's merely a lock-in of a plane of consciousness. There's no message being sent. Originally, people interpret somebody looking into their eyes as some social message, like a seduction or a power ploy, or asking for something or something like that, or even saying, "Are you there?" But for me, it's like a meditation focus, and it's a focus on a place in us where we're very clear and we're very loving and we're very present. It has no time in it. My eyes have no time in them. And so when I look at people, often they go through all their changes. Like when I work with an individual, when they come in just sort of off the street first round, they're not used to looking in somebody's eyes. So they say, "Well, let me tell you about my problem." And they're like looking at you sort of furtively and then slowly, and you're just sitting there talking to them. And then they say, "It's very difficult to look at you and talk." And I said, "I'm not having any difficulty doing it. Right? I'm right here. But that's okay, you know." And then slowly their eyes come back and back, and they get quieter and quieter until finally we're right here. And it just quiets the person down incredibly and brings them right to another space. But if there's something in you that wants something, the eyes become, that feeds the paranoia in the other person. You know? And that's why the eyes, it's very delicate to have these things, to be able to play with these things, because if you want something, it's really not fair. Karmically, it's not fair. It's heavy on you, really, to use that way. Yeah. Because I could imagine, I mean, being seen, if I sit and look into a camera, and if the vibratory rate doesn't come out right, people are going to say, "He's trying to form a cult. He's hypnotizing us." They'll start a mass protest if this thing is as powerful as I know it is. It's got to come with so much love and so much compassion and so gently, and so open and out front and talked about just like this evening is, that it's easy for everybody to handle it, right? Because if you just go and start doing this, it's like Svengali. I mean, you're really, it's power, because people interpret it as power. Yeah. So what happened once was I was doing an interview in Los Angeles on television with a fellow who has since died in an automobile accident, I think. And they told me, "Look at the interviewer," you know. But I turned around, it was in the acid days, and I turned around and I looked directly into the eye of the camera and I spoke directly to you, you know, right? You here, I'm here, far out. They said to me, like, "How has LSD affected you?" And I turned to the camera and said, "Well, I'll tell you." And I just did this thing. Well, that week they got something like 200 letters into the station saying, "That guy was in the middle of my head. What was that all about? What happened?" I mean, the experience was so intimate, it transcended the whole vehicle. Of course, I was stoned on something, I'm sure, on mescaline or something when I did it. But it reminded me, it gave me a clue of what this game is about, that the media are transmitters of our being. And very few beings have used it who don't have a shock going of some sort, really. It's the heaviest way of saying it.
What do you mean? Media is a transmitter of our...
being. Of our being. That means that what we really are comes through. Not what we present ourselves as being, but we really are.
Do you find that true also on television? I find that true on radio. Is that also true?
Also true on television, yes.
There's so much more distracting, though, about television, the way someone dresses.
It doesn't matter. Dressing, everything is a statement of being. And it's just terrible redundancy, actually. The way they sit, the way they move, their hands, the whole thing. When you watch the hands of a beautiful high being, and just, you know, everything about the way they get up, they sit down, you know, they're just very together. It's just flowing. It's not intentional flowing, it's just pure flowing. And that being can put people at ease. It can cut through paranoia if it's pure enough. You know, I just feel that if I can be, keep moving towards whatever formless truth is about, and the closest, and not cling to the forms it manifests in, and keep going back to the formless, and into the form, and back to the formless, and keep right at that edge all the time, that it cuts through such deep paranoia in people, because it gives them a chance to make a contact at a place they just don't have a chance to make a contact at most of the time. And that the heaviest karma would be to be so close to that and then use it for something personal. Because that would be the ultimate. They would feel the paranoia when they started to open. They would finally get one final waft of paranoia, and it would make them cynical in a way that would make it much harder for them to ever open again. Right? So that the trust is very delicate in that sense, about being able to tune to those places. And that's usually what drives me away from teaching, is the fear of the impurity about it all. But as a vehicle, we transmit our beings, and I think that, like somebody, there's an old Hasidic story. I didn't go to study the Torah with him. I came to watch him tie his shoes. Yeah. And really, that's like a Gurdjieff saying, if you know how to make a cup of tea right, you got it. Yeah. And you can feel that it should be just in the style of life. I said to somebody who wanted to go on the road with me, I said, the way you entertain is beautiful. You're a very high entertainer, but your life isn't together. And I only want to be on the stage with people whose whole life is a statement of what they are. And your life is a statement of what you are, and it's not together. And if your methods are working, you should clean up your act. And when you get your act together, then we'll play. But I'm very tough about that. I mean, I really feel that you can't say, well, I'm high now, but the other aspect of my life stinks. You know, and that's what happens on television. All these people come on and they smile and they grin and they're all very loving and beautiful, and then they go off television, and back in the back room, it's all a other trip. Well, I don't like back room other trips, you know. It's always been true of every time I've been connected with entertainment or media. There's always one personality projected outward and another one that's back home, you know. Well, to me, the integrity of that is what the secret of the depth of being and the trust. And it feels to me like millions of people are ripe for truth. That when you come through with a straight message, they hear it. I don't feel any doubt that if it's straight, people will hear it. And the thing is, it's like understanding that the ultimate power is the power of love. That when Maharaji said to me, all the money in the world is mine, or things like that, I understand now what he was talking about. Because you can feel that as you tune to that truth, and as you sort of die into it, you can just feel the intense, immensity of the power and the force of the process. Because nobody can resist pure truth and pure love. I mean, they can resist it if it's karmic for them to do it. At the same moment, it's like his name, washing his hands as he's committing Christ to death, you know? Pontius Pilate. It's an interesting place about, I can't say nobody can resist it, because karmically they can resist it if they have to resist it.
Even politicians are beginning to play the game.
Yeah.
Of truth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But the thing is, it has to be such deep truth of your being.
Yeah.
You know, and partly, in a way, my whole sexual number is a great boon for me, because it gives me a chance to, in a way, exhibit a private space in such a way that it gives license, it says to people, you can be just what you are, and you can still be a respected human being in a society and all that, you know. And I feel that that's a, like I got, well, the first time I gave an interview, an interesting story about that. There was a guy who I had been working with, writing with, and we were in New York finishing a book. And we were at a hotel. This is a very far out story, but it should go on television too, on the radio too. And we were at a hotel, and we had the night off. And I went out and I met a guy, and I came back and I slept with him. He's since become a very famous star, by the way, the guy I slept with. And he'll go nameless tonight. And, because that's his privilege. Well, the fellow I was working with was not a very morally good person, and he had put a tape recorder in my room, a bug, and he had taped the whole thing. So sometime later, when I was in his home territory, he asked me to do something for him, to write something, and I said, well, I didn't think I had time to write it. And he said, well, you better. He said, because I have this tape of you with this guy in this room. So I saw exactly what my predicament was right at that moment, right? And I immediately went to, I don't remember whether it was the Berkeley Barb or the Oracle or something, but I called up and I said, I'd like to give an interview. And I talked about my homosexuality. And I immediately got it published. It was within 2 weeks it was on the street, right? And I sent the guy a copy, and I said, okay, it's your move, right? And that was the last time I've ever seen him, right? And in a way, because I realized that if you're going to be a public person, the vulnerability of any kind of secret at all, you know, like, I don't want to have secrets. I want to just be right here. Because the minute you got something to protect, boy, and that's what I do when I'm working with individuals. I say, look, everything you think you got to protect from me is the stuff that's closing you off from the universe around you. There's nothing that you could have ever done or thought or felt or feel or want that makes any difference to me at all. It's just stuff. What are you making such a big deal about? But everybody's got their stuff. And, oh, if they knew, they would never. They knew that I pick my nose or whatever you do. You know, everybody's got stuff. So I say, you want to get free? They say, yeah, I want to get free. This is called Guts Ball. It's a heavy game. And I say, all right, if there is anything you can bring into your mind that you can't tell me, tell me. And that's right to the edge, right there, okay? And then they, I want to fuck you, right, okay, now what else? We have to bleep that, do we? All right. I want to bleep you. Okay. Right. And then we got to keep the eye contact all the time, see, which is far out. Because what happens is the eyes are one plane of consciousness and the bloop is another plane. So they do the bloop, all the stuff comes out. Like when I was 8, I had sex with my mother or something like that, you know. And then they tell you this. And then the eyes sort of get frightened around the edges of the eyes. The eye is still there, but it sort of gets a little kind of pulls back inside itself, you know. And you're just sitting there, and you sit with it because whatever they say affects me too. And I got to sit with it too until I've chomped it up, you know. Let it go. And I say, well, we're still here, aren't we? Person says, yeah, we're still here. Far out. Well, that's that one. What else is new? If there's anything you can bring to mind that you can't share with me, share it. And we just go through level after level after level after level until there's just nothing left. And as you do it, you can feel the person. It's just like shedding and shedding. But the secret is, you can't have any reaction to what they're saying. And you can't have a non-reaction. You've got to be wide open, you know, and loving and flowing. But at the same moment, you can't be judgmental. So you've got to really be the third Chinese patriarch. It's just like giving, in the American Indian thing, they call it the eater of filth, you know, and we did that at Lama where I said, okay, I said to 100 people, I'm going to be the eater of filth. It's like confession in the Catholic Church. It's voluntary. I'll be in this little place outside in the yard, one cell, and there'll be a bell ringer, and you can come in and you'll have 4 minutes. And I'll just sit there, and I'll look in your eyes, and if there's anything you can't tell me, tell me. Right? And I took 100 people. And boy, you hear the whole chronicle of human stuff. I mean, everybody's got something. And what is it all about? It's all stuff. And everybody's stuff is their stuff, and it's so important until it's just stuff, you know. And they walk out having left it. They gave it to me. you know. And I, they say, are you going to get stuck with it? I'm only going to get stuck with it if I want it. If I want to hold on to it because it's fascinating or it's ugly or something, I'll get stuck with it. Otherwise, it goes through me like, as I say, like Chinese food.
It's not exactly like the priest in the confessional. And
no, that's
out,
a judgmental,
you know,
thing.
See, doling out Hail Marys. And
exactly. Because the karma, they've already paying the karma by the, you know, for whatever, if the karma is the thing itself.
I was just thinking about over the weekend at Santa Cruz, you were sitting out on the patio talking with a friend of ours, and we had some disagreements. You and the friend had some disagreements. And one of the things that came up in the middle of the argument was, he says, after all, I have 5 children to support, and you have none. And it brought to my mind the differences between the householder and the celibate. Or I had to say to you celibate because I don't know about you, but I'm practicing celibacy, but I'm not always perfect in my practice, so I don't know what your situation is now. But say the household and the celibate, just for words.
I practice lust, but I'm not very good at my practice. You can consider me celibate. No, I don't really have any rules of the game at all.
But it was the difference in the lifestyles, as far as spiritual paths are concerned, between the householder and the celibate. The celibate is free to travel all over the world and do his thing anywhere, whereas the householder has to stay home and support the family. And I'm personally running up against differences with my householder friends. Mm-hmm. I have trouble understanding. You know, I could appreciate that they've got this to work out, and I've got something else.
Yeah. But they, just the way you said it shows your value system, because you said the celibate's free to wander around the world, the householder has to stay at home. How about the celibate has to keep wandering and the householder is free to stay at home? I mean, it's all in which, where you place the emphasis, you know, in terms of where the values are. And really, compassion is the appreciation of individual differences in dharma, that each individual has their dharma. And finally, the thing that brings you closest to God is to be in harmony with your own way of manifesting. And for someone who has children, to grab at a practice that involves not having children is adharmic. And for someone that doesn't have children, to necessarily live as a householder and accrue possessions and all is equally adharmic. And in a way, all we're seeing is learn that the grass isn't greener on the other side of the street. I mean, I wander around in a van alone, all right? At times, I am very lonely. At times, I'm very blissful. I have friends who have children. At times, they are overjoyed, and at times, it's a horror show. It's true for all forms, and it's not going to get any better. If you throw over this wife, the next wife's going to be a problem, too, sooner or later. You know, it's not... You finally learn to explore and acknowledge what you are, and you quiet your mind to hear your manifestation, and you stop judging which way it ought to be so much.
There's one other thing, the way the ego creeps up for me in this situation is, I remember what St. Paul said, that it's better not to marry because he who marries has to think of his wife or her husband rather than think of God.
Yes.
And I always think that we, even though we're homosexual, are lucky.
Yes.
And it's easier for us to break these attachments.
But
and I always,
from karmic point of view, that the sexual proclivities represent attachments too. And attachments are attachments. And a householder can be a householder, as in the Buddhist tradition, can be a householder with no attachment and be a perfect householder. Be a perfect mother and yet not be lost in identification as a mother. And yet is a perfect mother and a spacious mother for their child. And so it seems to me, I see, when people say, should I get married? Would it be better if I didn't get married? I say, look, the road through is tough. You know, narrow is the gate, believe me. And if you're going to spend the rest of your life wishing you were married, there are more, as I've said in my lectures and tapes, there are more horny celibates, believe me, mm-hmm. that are spending all their time lusting. And if you had a wife and children, it would cool you out and you could get on with your work, right? So that if you're supposed to have a partner, get on with it. And if you're not supposed to have a partner, don't. But don't spend all the time on the fence. I mean, listen, go, and then relax into it, right? And I used to have these long, deep yearnings for family, but I saw that the yearnings were at the level of my, like, primordial animalness, and that behind them, whatever kind of yogi I was, it had nothing to do with being a family person. I kept trying. I kept wanting to. I kept getting involved. And Maharaji kept calling Caroline, who was the girl that I used to live with, he kept calling her Mrs. Ramdas. I mean, nothing. What more than your guru calling this girl Mrs. Ramdas? And we all assumed it was in the cards. Right? And it wasn't in the cards. It wasn't to be. And he was just burning it out in her and burning it out in me. And I don't know, maybe next week I'll get married. Right? I mean, I'm not going to label the game at all. I really am. People say, do you take drugs? Do you have sex? Are you going to marry? I don't know. What difference does it make? What difference does it make?
You're also saying, don't take me as a model, then.
Hmm? I hope not.
There's always that danger. And I realize that all through your, quotes, career, that you've tried to avoid that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it would be a drag to watch 100 like me walk out of the street. I'll tell you.
There are some who wouldn't think it'd be so bad.
I think that we really have escaped that a lot. I mean, there are systems like in Werner Erhard's Est. They all look like little Werner Erhard's. And they do turn out people that look a lot, you know, and I mean, I'm being... That little sharpness is coming into my little game now. I love it. Come on, <we're> but I think the most people see through that level of imitation and don't buy into it too much, and realize they have to grow in their own way. I think most teachers support people growing in individual differences and growing in their own way, and they don't try to lockstep people in. Some of them do it because the discipline is required, like in the Hare Krishna movement. You know, you've got to have everybody doing the same. It's a total program, total push program.
You really feel that?
Hmm?
You really do feel that?
What?
That they're not turning out carbon copies.
You mean Hare Krishna?
I mean in most of the disciplines. So I really haven't found that to be the case. It always seems that they're modeled after the guru.
I feel that there's a stage. Like if you go to Boulder now, you see all the Trungpa students in ties and jackets and suits, and that's like a Trungpa, okay? And they all sound like Trungpa, and they look like Trungpa, and they talk about spaciousness. They use the same words. It's all the same thing. But I see that as a stage people go through, really. And that when they get the deeper teaching, that's merely, they kind of hone in. First you wear the cloth, and then you wear the, you know, the facial expression, and then you begin to wear the heart, and then the external stuff is irrelevant. I was much more attached to my Hindu baggage, you know, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, than I am now.
Well, you've been in and out of it so often that it's hard to keep track.
Yeah.
I love it.
What's my... I have a Tibetan name, too. Karma... forgotten. I'll remember.
No, it's very interesting to see you, you know, return to sweaters and slacks and get out of the way.
I never know what to wear anymore, you know. I can't figure out what I'm supposed to do, you know. I had all these nice clothes made in Bangkok because you could make the suits for $20, and I came back and everybody said I looked like I bought them out of the catalog at Sears Roebuck. And I mean, I don't know how to do this. I just want to live cheaply and, you know, and comfortably and be presentable, you know? And have it all be able to go into the laundromat, you know, when I wash my clothes.
Right on.
It's far out because being a single person, you know, there are certain things I've built into my rituals. Like, I'm most comfortable when I'm cooking for myself, when I'm washing my own clothes. I have a very hard time playing the role of being a guru in the cultural, traditional sense, where people feed you and cook for you, you know, and clean your clothes and take care of your rooms and drive your car and all that. And I'm wondering, like last week I let somebody do my laundry, and I was very aware that I was doing this, you know, and I felt distinctly uncomfortable. But I have a feeling, finally, that there are times when I like to let my consciousness space out more, and it would be awfully nice sometimes if someone was taking care of me, you know. But unfortunately, with most people that come to take care of you, goes along a personality and all that stuff that goes with it, and it's more fun to go off in the van by myself.
There's also the danger of beginning to expect it of people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
To stay clear on that level is sometimes very difficult.
I have such fun in the van. It's really such a ball, just staying in these places, sometimes in like KOA camps with just dozens and dozens of other beings who are beautiful beings. There's a great beauty in people who travel around in these, in trailers and mobile homes and all that stuff. You know, they're very nice people. And we, you know, one guy, we walked in and, at a state park, and I walked in the morning and he was trying to shave, and he says, he looks at me and he says, "How do you shave in this cold water?" And he's looking right at me and he's asking the question, and I didn't even register. The guy didn't even realize it. Even like cutting the beard is a funny one, you know? Oh, by the way, I use Grecian formula number 16. you spilled the glass. There was nothing in it, though. Because my beard got so white that everybody was treating me like I was this old guy. I mean, it started to get all this respect and everything from age, and I just thought, the hell with that, who wants that? But I figured if I tell everybody, then it's okay. If I do it devious, then it's bad.
I got the lid off.
I can't shave, it's a drag. Then every time I stop at Laura Huxley, she cuts my beard. She loves to cut my beard.
She once cut your hair in the desert, didn't she?
No, the beard.
Was it the beard?
Yeah. Not the hair. The hair's never been cut, it's just fallen out. No. Wouldn't let anybody cut my hair.
Was that? I remember when you had just returned from that.
That was an initiation she gave me when she cut the beard.
Wow. She's one of those people that's worth being initiated by.
She and I are doing a conference in April in Los Angeles. That's the first lecture I'll be giving again. It's a weekend with French fellow of the birth,
Le Boyer,
and Ashley Montague, and some Jean Houston, I guess. And Laura wants to start she calls it the ultimate investment. It has something to do with mothers and children at a very, very early age.
Yes.
And so I love Laura, and if Laura asked me to do anything, I would do it for her. You know?
This all came out of her concept of minus one plus five. She feels is very, very important
yeah.
formative time
right.
in a
and
child.
And it's interesting because I was trained as a child development psychologist, in which that was the period I dealt with, was the first 5 years of life.
That's interesting.
I used to run a nursery school, and all my research is in identification. I have a book out with Bob Sears from Stanford, who was chairman of the psych department on identification and child rearing, Stanford University Press, which talks about early child development of personality by Freudian theory.
There's an aspect of that that I think that it would appeal to you, that she had arrived at, I believe, about a year ago, and that was to use the very elderly as
babysitters. Yes,
yeah,
I know.
And so both ends of the spectrum coming
yes.
together, you know.
Yes.
Really, that the elderly can give the degree of love that's needed by a child.
Yeah. What we're doing in the Dying Project now, it's not the right name for it, I'm sure, the Dying Project, but we haven't got a name for it yet.
But you have returned to it.
Hmm?
You have really returned to it now.
Hmm. We're really tooling up and getting ready now, because it's going to be a heavy one. I suspect it may be the heaviest thing I've ever been involved in. To me, the most exquisite sadhana I ever do are the periods of time when I'm sitting with somebody that's dying. Because it's right here. It's right on. I mean, you're dealing with pain and you're dealing with the loss of ego. It's just the stuff of awakening. And it is very attractive to literally thousands of people to work with dying people now. They are ready to deal with that. And there are many, many... See, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and I have worked together a lot, but where we differ, and this is a very interesting thing that raises an interesting issue, where we differ is Elizabeth works with all people that are dying, like Stan Grof did with LSD, and I don't do that. I say awakening is an evolutionary thing, and there are very few people that really want to awaken. And I'm only interested in those people who say, I would like to use my death as a vehicle for awakening. I don't want to seduce anybody into, let them die the way they want to die. If they want to die holding on to their life, that's all right with me. I'm not going to lay a trip on people. But if somebody says to me, would you help me die consciously? Then great, let's work together, right? So that I'm an elitist in that sense, in that I only work with certain kinds of people. Right? She works with all people, you know?
As does Charlie Garfield.
Yeah, well, now the difference, the next difference is that Charlie and Elizabeth primarily work with the psychological aspects of dying. They primarily work with the fear and the loneliness and the separation and the lack of communication, and they're truly trying to make it comfortable and okay to die. Okay, and all right for the family to have grief, and all right for everybody to go through all the stages of dying and all that. That is all exquisite work. It came out of the hospice movement originally from England. Beautiful stuff. I honor it. I think it should be done. It isn't my work in dying, okay? I am particularly interested in dying as a transitional stage that is useful in the vehicle of awakening. I'm not the least bit interested in dying per se. Right? People die all the time, and they're going to continue to die, and we're not going to stop them dying. What I am interested in is that it's a very useful time for awakening. Right? And the predicament is that when you start to work with dying people, unless your compassion is very, very evolved, if it's any less than very, very evolved, you are totally vulnerable to getting caught back into the psychological stuff. And you end up being concerned with kindness and happiness and all of these things, and you forget what the game is about. And it's very, very tremendous discipline on yourself to remember that the issue is awakening, not dying.
Which may take the form of terror.
Whatever.
Whatever.
Whatever. Whatever. It's just that you stay right with that process.
Not to placate anyone.
No, you don't run from anything, and you just keep turning it. It's all grist for the mill. That's what it is, okay? So what I like to do is I like to run an ashram next summer or fall with Steve Levine and a few other people probably, in which we I'd like to put an ad, say, in the like New Age Journal or East West Journal, however you do these kinds of things, Yoga Journal, saying, Ram Dass invites members of the spiritual community with terminal illnesses to join with him, who would like to use their illness as a vehicle for awakening, to join with him and other ashramites for a two-week ashram, okay? And then maybe have 50 people who are terminally ill in advanced stages, all done by questionnaire and all this, and 150 other people who aren't immediately dying, everybody dies sooner or later. Then the first week, like the first few days, would be pretty much in the Kubler-Ross tradition of bringing out all of the stages, the anger, the denial, the rejection, the bargaining, all of these things, bringing out the psychological stuff really heavy. I mean, I would like a psychological leader to do that, to just bring the stuff out. And most of the 150 people will be meditating on this material, and mostly it'll be the 50 people that are dying, because it's such an awesome experience. The first time I went to one of Elizabeth's seminars, the only time I went, actually, it blew my mind, because for 3 days I couldn't say a word. I mean, it was just so overwhelming, the power of the immediacy of the problems of dying in America, or anywhere, you know. I mean, just falling down the stairs and all the stuff, and it just pulls on you. I mean, it just pulls everywhere you can be pulled, you know. All right, let it do all its pulling for a few days. Right? And then I would like to enhance the whole process by a series of experiences. For example, I would like to deal with films on Auschwitz, on Dachau, on Hiroshima. I would like to use them as meditation exercises. When I was in Bangkok, Thailand, there was a museum, a Buddhist museum, within a temple compound that had like 20 little viewers, like you go to a science thing, and you push a button, a light would go on, and it was a body in the stages of decomposition, and being the skin being taken off, and the decay, and so on, till it was a skeleton at one end, it was a person at one end. These were photographs of this process, really very powerful photographs. Right? And then there was another big exhibit that had the bottles and all, and it showed the human body has this much phlegm, and there's the pubic hair, and it was all just there, in just like containers, the whole body, the bones all ground up, and so much carbon, so much this, and so much that. And I'd like to have a series. This is the same thing as the cemetery meditations in the Theravada tradition. Right? In other words, during the first week, I would like to burn out the drama of dying, right? So that by the second week, at the end of the first week, we can flip the whole thing around and turn the second week into a straight ashram in which everybody participates. And we put dying into the perspective of awakening rather than having a dying seminar, okay? In other words, Elizabeth runs seminars about dying, really. I'm interested in seminars about awakening. I just want to use dying as the vehicle, right? And I'm hoping through that process to make a statement about perspective and to start to maybe save the whole problem of having to set up a center, which is the one that I'd rather not have to do immediately. Right? So that one is, that's a very intriguing one that really turns me on a great deal. Because I love to bring out stuff in which everybody gets caught and then cut through it. You know, it's like somebody's story is so poignant, you can hardly bear it. You know, I'd like to have film strips of the most dramatic moments in films that have ever been, of the things, like if I do a television series, one of the things I want to do in the television series is have a television camera on stage that the camera shows and run, say, a news events of the year broadcast where they have intense things that caught everybody, you know, and then run the event and then stop it and then work with the consciousness of what you were feeling as you watched the event until finally you can use the news as a vehicle for awakening rather than as a vehicle to get lost into the drama, right? And I'd like to take old film strips and run them like 3 or 4 minutes until you really, you just, your heart's being pulled or your anger or your righteousness or your violence, and then stop and then discuss and deal with the thing that it awakened in us until pretty soon people start to use television as a vehicle for awakening. We got another game I want to play where the camera starts in on the television screen, it's focused on the screen, and I'm on the screen talking, and that seems like what's happening. And then the camera backs up, and you see that you were just looking at a television screen, and there I am sitting next to the camera, right? So I say, see, you thought that was me, but actually I'm over here, right? And the other one's still talking, but the sound's turned off now. And then I say, but of course this isn't me either, because this is on tape. Right? See, actually, I'm sitting looking at this just like you are at this moment. So where are we? And just using the whole thing to kind of play with time and space, right?
Beautiful.
I want to do some by streams. That'll be nice, by streams, where I read from the Tao, and then the camera focuses on the light and the water, and we just meditate together. I don't want to do meditations in every one of them. I could have such fun.
Yeah.
I will. If it's in the way of things.
And here comes Ramdas.
Yeah. Strangest thing happened on the way to Samadhi.
Five minutes of guru jokes.
Who handed me the cartoon the other day? Guy goes to the top of a mountain to ask guru somebody. You did.
I did.
It fuels some of the people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fuels some of the people some of the time.
I got another one today, which is two leaves talking to one another. See that one?
Mm-hmm.
A father leaf and a child leaf. And the leaf is saying, you know, we live such a short time, one season, and then we fall off. But you know, the stars live billions of years. Wouldn't it be nice to live that much? And the father says, everyone wants to be a star.
Around us, we don't have any video cameras, but we try our best with radio.
I think we do an extraordinary thing. I mean, the reason I keep coming back to you guys is because the consciousness level of the way we can work together is such a delight. I mean, there's just no hustle in it. We can just all be together. And it's interesting because there are certain, like, home spaces for me where I feel like running my whatever perceptions I have of the universe through your consciousness is just talking to you. Does stuff, it feeds me in certain ways, you know, it just cleans up my act a lot, you know, and I can hear stuff. And it's been a very mature way of sharing Dharma for all the years you've been into this game, you know. So, I don't think there's any place in the country now where I have this kind of way of working with the media and relating to people. You know, New York, WBAI has certainly gone political, or it's just sort of gone off the edge somewhere or other. It's very hard to work with it now. Paul Gorman was my connection there, and he was beautiful, and we worked great together, but that's not there anymore. And most of the other stations, it's all peripheral.
Lex Ixon's still there, isn't it?
Yeah, Lex is there. I'm the greatest preface writer in the whole world now. I write more prefaces than anybody else for a week. I wrote a
book of prefaces.
I'm going to have a book of prefaces now. I just wrote a blurb. I do blurbs when I'm not doing prefaces. I wrote a blurb for Lex Hickson's new book, which is a very nice book, by the way. Very nice.
Is it about the media?
No. It's essays on the different religious traditions done from Advaita Vedanta point of view, but done beautifully. I mean, he really gets into the Hasidic, the warmth and the humor of it. He really tries to capture the quality of each of the traditions. And he's got a beautiful intellect so that it intellectually feeds you at the same time as he hasn't lost the heart, which is, he's developing his heart is really what he's doing. Yeah, Lex is nice.
There are a few other people around the country, too.
It was just striking that, you know, this past weekend was the first time that we really have gotten into any kind of video. So it was kind of interesting that we wound up doing a video interview with you this past weekend.
That far out. Did that come out all right?
We haven't seen it, but we understand it came out well.
Wow. I did the whole Rhode Island retreat, I don't know when that was, 2 years ago, I guess, a year and a half ago, was videotaped in color. 3/4 inch. And it was run a couple of times on Aspen cable TV and got, I mean, people loved it. And they made up a program and they took it to PBS. And PBS was very attracted, but the timing wasn't good for them and they wanted to do special shows. I mean, it was one of the games, you know. And I could feel, no, it just means not yet. Because the color was beautiful and the show was beautiful. And slowly the stuff starts, the media start to... I think that the alternative, whatever the hell we're called, are becoming a real entity now for middle America, and therefore, and also the advent of the new video, not cassette, but discs, is going to change the name of the game a lot, you know. So, and all the media can be used for the transmission of the highest truths just as well as for the transmission of more illusion, you know, as you guys are showing. I think radio gives everything that is necessary for the transmission. You know, I don't think video is really necessary. I just think it's nice to also be able to use video.
Oh, there.
Yeah, it's there. It exists.
There's more people there, too, in video.
Yeah. I remember in the old days when I used to watch Alan Watts on television. Remember when Alan Watts used to be on, I think on Sunday morning, and he'd sit there in a...